Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. We're here to reconnect the eternal with the everyday. Make those connections between the headline news and the mind of Christ that, well, equip us to enter into the conversations of the day with grace and truth. That's my goal. I hope that's our shared goal, that we can be effective ambassadors of Jesus Christ in the midst of the conversations of our day. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. You can read my blogs and other ministry information at reconnectwithcarmen.com. And today at reconnectwithcarmen.com, you can get a free ebook, 10 Ways to Fan the Flame of a New Reformation. All you have to do is become a monthly supporter of the ministry. And so you can become a reconnector at reconnectwithcarmen.com. All right, so how do we bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headlines of the day? That's always the question before us. And so I'm going to actually reach back and grab a headline from this past weekend because it deserves our attention and I haven't been able to get to it yet. So the headline, in fact, you could pull it off of dozens of different websites. And so it came to us in the headline news in virtually every periodical, every newspaper across the country and even around the world. And it was in relationship to the bicentennial of the birth of Karl Marx. And so if you were to read the headline from the Wall Street Journal, you would have read, "Marx's apologists should be red in the face, the bicentennial of the man whose ideas killed untold millions." If you were to read the headline from The Economist, it would have been, "Second time, farce. Rulers of the word read Karl Marx on his bicentenary, Marx's diagnosis of capitalism's flaws is surprisingly relevant." All right, that's kind of a long headline and a mouthful. So let's talk for a moment about Karl Marx. And the reason we're going to talk about him is, man, did he have some bad ideas. And we talk about worldview. What we're talking about is the lens through which we look at everything. And we also talk about ideas having consequences. So good ideas have hopefully good consequences. Bad ideas always have bad consequences. And so when we talk about Karl Marx, if you want to look at what has happened through Marx's influence, the influence of his thinking, the influence of his ideas, I think the Wall Street Journal gets it really well, and so does The Economist. They get it really close to right, which is to say he had really bad ideas. His really bad ideas led to the deaths of untold millions. And we're talking about, you know, the worst idea in the 20th century, and that's communism. So if you wanted to turn to the Communist Manifesto, which he wrote with Friedrich Engels, then you would be looking at what we would call the Marx-Engels version of communism. And it's laid out in the Communist Manifesto. And it's actually a book that was read by a whole lot of people during a particular generation. It's read far less now. And here's the reality. People today who think that they want to be Marxist, or they want us as a country to be Marxist, or they want us to be one of the virulent strands of Marxism, they need to actually read what Marx said. And so if you were to read the Communist Manifesto, you would get the theory of communism summed up in what I would just in a single sentence, the abolition of private property. So just think about that for a minute. Anytime anybody is advocating any sort of Marxist ideas, socialism would be sort of the contemporary version. You need to say to them, okay, then I'm going to come and assert my ownership, my partial ownership at least, over everything you own. Hand me your car keys. I'll be at dinner at 6. Have the guest room ready. Like, the abolition of private property and the idea that no one would own anything is the primary principal idea behind Marxism. Here are a few quotes in Marx and Engels' own words. "You're horrified at our intending to do away with private property, but in your existing society, private property is already done away with for 9/10 of the population." What they're talking about there is that 10% of the population owned everything. And we have that sort of division, economic division in culture today. And so that's why you see people attacking the so-called 1%. Because they want the 1% to have all of their assets taken away and redistributed among the 99%. But let's recognize that if that were to happen, all of the things that are produced in and through and by the 1% would also be done away with. And so you very, very quickly devolve a culture when you do this. They went on to, this is again from the Communist Manifesto. This is Marx and Engels saying, in one word, you reproach us with intending to do away with your property. Precisely so, but that is just what we intend. Now, these guys acknowledge that their views stood undeniably contrary to the social and political order of the day. And they came right out and said, communism seeks to, quote, abolish the present state of things and represents, quote, the most radical rupture in traditional relations. Now, remember that the Communist Manifesto and communism in general is based on atheistic ideology. And so they have completely removed God and God's ordering of things from the conversation. That's completely removed. And so instead, what you get to replace it, you get not only atheism, but you get materialism. In fact, you get atheistic materialism. And if indeed communism were, as these guys proposed, to work, it would be dependent then upon altruism. Now, let me just ask you. If you have atheistic materialism operating as the dominant worldview, how are you ever going to arrive at the place of altruism? That just doesn't make any sense. And yet, it's what these guys were literally banking on, keeping in mind that what we're talking about here is an economic policy, right? We're not necessarily talking about the way you and I would think about a form of government, although communism became a form of government. What we're really talking about here is economic theory. So in the preface to their 10 points, Marx and Engels actually acknowledge the coercive nature of all of this. They say, of course, in the beginning, then they mean that, like, right now, if you were to take any culture, like the United States of America, and you were to move it in the direction of communism, Marxism, which, you know, I got to tell you, we got a whole generation of people thinking this socialism business is a good idea. They say, this is where you got to read these guys. They say, of course, in the beginning, this cannot be effected except by means of despotic inroads. And at the close of the Communist Manifesto, they say this: the communists openly declare that their ends can be attained only by the forcible withdrawal of all existing social conditions. So, it would require every one of us giving up our fundamental liberties. Those inalienable rights that are guaranteed to you in the Constitution, those would need to go away. And so anytime you see an assault on the First Amendment, anytime you experience an assault on religious liberty, on free expression, on the freedom of the press, I need you to think about the kinds of existential threats to our way of life that exist, because they exist in the arena of bad ideas. It would have been one thing for Marxist Engelism, or Marx-Engels version of communism, to actually come about. What came about was Leninism and Stalinism and Maoism, and what we would look at in the Marxist version of government in Cuba. Okay, and the only ones that really survive today are the ones in China and Cuba. And even those, you know, frankly, have been virtually undone by the fact that there really is free market enterprise in both of those nations, because everybody recognizes Marx is a failure. And in fact, any contemporary version of it would be a farce. All right, friends, I got to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to have a great conversation with Rabbi Steve Lader. And he is the rabbi at the Wilshire Avenue Synagogue in L.A. And this is a conversation you don't want to miss. I'm Carmen LaBerge. This is Connecting Faith. We'll be right back.
Hi.
All right, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back. I am thrilled to be joined by Rabbi Steve Leader. Rabbi Leader is the senior rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple of Los Angeles. It's actually one of America's largest congregations with more than 10,000 adherents. He's the author of critically acclaimed books, including The Extraordinary Nature of Ordinary Things and More Money Than God, Living a Rich Life Without Losing Your Soul. You can see him on every major national news outlet when they need to call upon a Jewish theologian and pastor to comment on cultural trends and current events. And you can also read what he's writing and get more information at steveleader.com. Leader is spelled L-E-D-E-R. Rabbi Leader, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen. I'm very honored to be with you today.
Okay, so you're a Jewish rabbi serving God in one of the largest synagogues in America. There are lots of things that I want to discuss with you, but let's actually start with your newest book. And then after that, I hope we can talk about relations between Christians and Jews in the U.S. Does this sound like a good plan?
Yes, of course.
So your newest book is More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. And I think that in a world where lots of people spend most of their lives trying to avoid suffering at all costs, you actually unmask a really important truth, and that is that to be human is to suffer. Talk with us about that.
Well, yes, I think that, you know, pain and suffering, and by that I mean all forms of physical and emotional pain, makes people feel quite isolated and alone. That's the worst part of pain. But if you think about it, it's actually the common denominator between all of us, Christians, Jews, Muslims, all of us, male, female, people of color, all of us, our common denominator is our humanity, and to be human is to suffer. You know, I say in the introduction to the book that sooner or later, every one of us walks through hell, and there are many kinds of hell, Carmen. There's the hell of divorce, the hell of cancer, the hell of a kid in trouble, the hell of depression, of anxiety, of you know, physical pain, of a ruined reputation, the hell of betraying someone else, and the hell of being betrayed. There are many, many forms of hell. We all walk through hell. And what I say in the book is that the point is not to come out empty-handed. You know, Dostoevsky said that his greatest fear was that his life would not be worthy of his suffering. I think that's such a powerful idea. Can we lead a life worthy of our suffering? And you know, since we're people of faith, I can put it to you this way. I can't imagine anything more Christ-like than leading a life worthy of our suffering.
Well,
it's a powerful idea.
And yeah, and that's certainly true, you know, for those who study the Hebrew scriptures, you know, we would be looking here at lots of stories in the Old Testament where suffering is just a very, it seems almost rhythmic in terms of the experience of the Jewish people. And then I think that for Christians, you know, you've articulated that beautifully. I mean, we recognize that we are aligned with a suffering Savior.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, by the way, let me be clear for all of us. In no way is it my intention to glorify or idealize suffering or pain. You know, pain is just that, pain. It hurts. It really, really hurts. And none of the lessons we learn from pain are worth the suffering. But my point is, neither are they worth less. Each time we face suffering, it comes to teach us something. You know, the sages of the Talmud, the ancient Hebrew sages said, if you are visited by pain, examine your life. So pain is really an invitation to change our lives. Success, frankly, doesn't teach us very much. You know, success just kind of teaches us to keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. It's really only pain, something deeply disruptive in our hearts and souls, that forces us to change our lives. And those changes can be very much for the better.
Well, you say that we're only truly whole after we've been broken somehow.
Yes.
And you talk there about empathy and wisdom and kindness that are, you know, that are some of the benefits. I mean, I think when you're talking about walking through hell and not leaving empty-handed, I think that what you're articulating is learn empathy there, learn wisdom there, learn kindness there.
Precisely. You know, in the book of Deuteronomy, it says God places his words upon our hearts. And the sages ask a very interesting question, which is, why does it say upon our hearts and not in our hearts? Certainly, God has the power to place his words in our hearts. So why does God place his words upon our hearts? And the answer the sages give is that God places his words upon our hearts, and it isn't until our hearts are broken that the words can enter.
Mm.
So beautiful, really.
That is beautiful.
And, you know, and so true. There is a kind of wholeness that only results from brokenness.
Absolutely. All right, friends, I'm talking with Rabbi Steve Leder. Leder is spelled L-E-D-E-R. That matters because you're going to go to steveleder.com to follow what he's writing and to get more information about the best-selling new book that we're discussing now, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. You talk about your own suffering and how it changed the way that you respond to people who come to you in pain. How so?
Well, this book was the result of having lived for a relatively pain-free life for 27 years as a rabbi, taking care of thousands of people and helping them through their suffering. And believe me, when you're the rabbi for 10,000 people, you see a lot of suffering, terribly painful things. You know, I've had to help parents bury a child in a casket the size of a shoebox. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people through so many difficult things. And I thought I knew something about suffering and was, frankly, doing a pretty good job of ministering to people during their times of pain and abandonment. And then about 3.5 years ago, I was in a very frightening car accident. And to make a long story short, that car accident resulted in months on opioids and steroids, and then finally spinal surgery and more months on opioids and depression and, you know, a kind of downward spiral that brought me into a kind of darkness I had never experienced before. And that was after experiencing, for there's no word other than torture, torturous physical pain through my lower body because of the spinal injury. And what I realized in that experience is that despite my best efforts during those previous 27 years to help people through pain, I actually knew very little or nothing about pain. And so this book, in a sense, is my effort to set the record straight on pain. And it's really not a book about me other than the introduction. It's a
right.
book about this trajectory that that we all need to go through. The book is divided into three sections: surviving, healing, and growing, which from my perspective is the trajectory of pain and suffering, ideal trajectory.
Well, I want to talk about a few specific things from the book to give people a little bit of a taste and see of what's in here. You talk about in the book about saying, I'm sorry, but I think maybe more importantly, in hurt and run. You talk about three essential words that we really do have to learn to speak if we're ever going to find healing and reconciliation. And those three words are, I was wrong. Talk about that.
Yes, so powerful. So one of the things the book does, which I think is rare, there are many books on pain. I didn't invent a genre here. But one of the things that's unusual in More Beautiful Than Before is it deals with the question of, what do you do when you are the cause of pain to another person? What do you do when you are the betrayer, not the betrayed? Because that brings with it its own kind of shame and pain and guilt and remorse. Then what? How do you make things right? And in this essay in the book called Hurt and Run, I talk about the power of the three most difficult words for human beings to say, which you correctly pointed out are not, I'm sorry. I am sorry leaves an awful lot of wiggle room. Any of us who are married know that. You know, I'm sorry could mean I'm sorry you feel that I did this, or I'm sorry that you think I said that. Whatever it is, there's a lot of latitude in I am sorry. Much more powerful are the words I was wrong. I was wrong is a much higher degree of culpability and responsibility. There's no ambiguity in those three words. I was wrong. And I have found over and over again in my own life, and as I counsel others, the start of healing in a fractured relationship, in a painful break, is the ability with sincerity and humility to say those three words, I was wrong. It changes everything, and it makes a different future possible.
I'm trying to imagine right now how many of our cultural conversations would be different, would be radically changed.
You are so right.
If one or both of us would be willing to say, I was wrong.
Yes, you know, doubt is so important. Without doubt, you have nothing but fanaticism and deafness to the perspective of the other. Doubt is so important. It's so important to think to oneself, maybe she does have a point. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I could have behaved differently. Doubt is so important to preserving love itself.
Friends, my conversation partner is Rabbi Steve Leader. We're talking about his newest book, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. And I want you to check out everything that he's writing at steveleader.com. Steve, before we go to a break, let's talk about the dangers of the comfortable life. To be blind to the suffering of others in order to be comfortable ourselves is a really grievous sin. So can you address that?
Sure. You know, Peter Drucker, the business guru, said that if you're comfortable, it's a sure sign that you're doing something wrong. In writing that chapter in the book called Be Uncomfortable, back then, and this was about 3 years ago now, the book took that long. It just came out, but it took me 3 years to write. I Googled most comfortable, those two words, most comfortable, and there were 347 million most comfortables. Most comfortable chair, most comfortable bed, most comfortable shoes, you name it. And if you spend enough money, you can have the most comfortable of it. And it occurred to me just how much of our lives we spend in pursuit of being comfortable. But to be comfortable also requires turning a blind eye to the suffering of others. You have to look the other way at the hungry and the homeless and the widow and the orphan and the stranger and the poor in order to be comfortable. So from my perspective, this is another one of those areas where pain is the great teacher. Be uncomfortable. Put yourself in places and positions and with people that force you to question your own assumptions, that force you to reach out and uplift another human being. To raise another person from his or her suffering, I believe, is the holiest of acts. But in order to do that, we have to be willing to expose ourselves to discomfort. Comfortable people don't interest me very much. They're pretty dull.
All right, friends, you can send your comments to Steve. No, I'm just kidding. Because I mean, right? We recognize that we're trying, we actually are trying to achieve a level of comfort, and you're calling us on it, and that makes us uncomfortable. So,
you know, it's an old saying in my business that the minister's job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, friends, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to continue my conversation with Rabbi Steve Leader. You can visit him at steveleader.com. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined in this hour by Rabbi Steve Leader. He is the senior rabbi of the Wilshire Boulevard Temple of Los Angeles, one of America's largest Jewish congregations. He's the author of several critically acclaimed books, and we have been talking about his latest book, which is More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Steve, at the end of the last segment, we were talking about being made uncomfortable and that you were sort of welcoming that. So now I'm going to move to the uncomfortable part of the interview. Is that okay?
Sure, of course.
So, yeah. Because, right, so you are, you're a Jewish rabbi, and yeah. I am just going to, as an evangelical Christian, I'm going to now just stomp all over whatever sort of social norms there are about things we're not supposed to talk about or things we're not supposed to admit that we think or wonder, and I'm just going to have the, what is it like to be Jewish in America today conversation.
Sure, I welcome that, of course.
So what is it like? That is the question.
Yeah. Well, it's almost Dickinsonian. It's the best of times and worst of times, of course. Now, why is it the best of times? I cannot think of any other time in all of Jewish history when it has been better to be a Jew than in 21st century America. We are accepted, free, and welcomed in a way that has been extremely rare for Jews throughout our long and difficult history. So America is a very special place, by the way, not only for Jews, but for all people of faith. We have a kind of freedom here that I think we often take for granted. Most Jews I know do not. Now, the other side of that, of course, is that America is also a place based on the autonomy of the individual. It's a place pretty much about doing whatever it is you want to do as long as you don't hurt anyone else. We live in a popular culture that's very seductive. And it's a place where Jews can essentially stop being Jewish, can disappear in a sense. I remember I'm very good friends with an African-American film director. And he was one time he said to me, "Steve, why are you Jews so obsessed with assimilation? Why are you so worried all the time?" By the way, his name is John Singleton, who, wrote and directed Boys in the Hood and all those important movies. And John said to me, "Steve, why are you so obsessed with, you know, assimilation and Jews disappearing in America? It's never been better for Jews." And I said, "John, let me ask you something. If African-Americans tomorrow could wake up and take a pill that made them white, how many of them would take the pill?" And he said to me, "Most." And I said, "America is that pill for Jews. We can shorten our names and we can just disappear if we choose to and be seduced, you know, by the art museum and the symphony and Netflix and whatever else it is that becomes people's religion." And that's the danger. So, you know, freedom is liberating, but it also requires a degree of self-discipline that many people lack. So being a Jew in America, for me as a Jewish leader, is on the one hand liberating and full of possibilities, and on the other hand, I'm fighting so hard for third place. I don't know, Carmen, if you know about this third place theory that sociologists talk about, but I'll tell you very quickly. If you ask most people what's first and second in their lives, they will say family and work. What religion in America is fighting for is third place. And there are a lot of things fighting for third place. So, you know, that's the challenge of being a Jewish leader in America. And I will say, you know, I just got back about 4 or 5 weeks ago from the National Religious Broadcasters Convention in Nashville, which blew my mind. It was utterly amazing for me to be around so many evangelical Christians who live Bible every day, who are comfortable with who they are, who are not ambivalent about their faith. It was incredibly refreshing for me because I'm dealing with a Jewish community that is being pulled in many directions and seduced in many ways, and as is, I think, mainstream Christianity in many ways. You know, I hear this from my friends in the churches up and down the street from the synagogue as well. And look, if we lived in the America of, you know, Jefferson and Lincoln, I would be okay trusting American values, you know, to sustain the values of the Bible through secular culture. But we don't live in the America of Jefferson and Lincoln. We live in the America of the Kardashians. Right. That's the problem, right?
Right.
So
yeah,
we cannot count on popular culture or even highbrow American culture to perpetuate the values you and I believe in. This is the great dichotomous tension of freedom in America.
Well, and I think that, you know, that's highlighted when we see contemporary research, you know, of conversations with, let's say, next generation and then the emerging generation of people who just, I mean, have absolute ignorance about the Holocaust. I mean, they don't even know what it was, let alone who died in it and why that matters and what that has to do with why Israel is a country. And I mean, on and on and on.
Yep.
People just have an incredible ignorance about these things.
And I'll tell you just how chilling that is. You and I will likely be alive when the last Holocaust survivor on Earth dies. Mm-hmm. When the last person on Earth who can say it happened because I was there and I saw it with my own eyes, that person is very likely now in his or her 80s or 90s. So we are soon going to be in a world where there will not be one person left who can swear as a witness to what happened. Mm. And that places an even further, deeper, more awesome responsibility upon our shoulders. And the other thing, of course, is, I don't think a religion of negativity has much of a chance at success. So we can't only identify ourselves with the tragedies of the past. We also have to make the positive case about why religion it makes our lives better.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I want to ask a question, and forgive me if I phrase it in a way that's offensive in any way, right? Because I just think that
we're on the same side. You go ahead.
Right. We don't talk yep. enough across, maybe even across is the wrong way to say it. So lots of
yes.
Christians, you know, frankly, know
yes.
very little about contemporary Judaism, and
right.
and know far fewer actual Jews. And so I think there are Christians who imagine that Judaism and Jews are monolithic when actually it's incredibly diverse. So
correct.
If you were going to identify sort of the theological tenets without which a person could not be a practicing Jew, what are those? And is it theological or is it biological?
This is the complex. It's an excellent question, Carmen, and this is the complexity of Judaism. It's both. It's a religion and it's a people. It's a religion and it's a nation state. It's a religion and it's a culture. And it's a religion into which people can convert. So it's not purely biological either. So it's all of those things from a religious standpoint.
Thank God for those of us who are counting on being engrafted in, by the way. So go ahead.
Yes. So I would say to your listeners, from a theological point of view, to be a Jew is to affirm the oneness of God, that there's a single unifying God principle force to all of existence. It is to believe in the fundamental teachings of what we call the Torah, which are the first five books of both the Hebrew and the Christian Bible. It is to hear the clarion voice of the prophets, and you know, frankly, in terms of Jews and Christians, there's far more that unites us than separates us. Really, technically, what separates us is whether or not the Messiah has actually arrived for the first time,
mm-hmm.
right? But other than that, and then that's a big other, I accept that, we have far more in common than we do that separates us. Now, of course, layered onto that, you have all the cultural manifestations of being a Jew. You have the food, you have the music, you have the dance, you have the language, all of that. And then you layer on top of that the fact that Jews have a nation state, the way Catholics have the Vatican, for example. So they're multi-levels of what it means to be a Jew and degrees to which Jews identify. There are theological differences in Judaism. There's as much diversity in Judaism theologically as there is in Christianity, the main one being the origins of Scripture. Is Scripture the divine revealed word verbatim of an omnipotent God, or are the words of Scripture words written by humans who were inspired by God and trying to put down on parchment at the time that which they believed God required of them and wanted of them? And what it meant to lead a godly life, what it meant to be a humane human being. So the origins of Scripture, that really is what creates so much theological diversity within Judaism. Hmm. Other than that, there's a tremendous, almost tribal bond among Jews. But again, it's also not biological because many, many people convert into Judaism.
All right, friends, my conversation partner is Rabbi Steve Leder. You can check out what he's writing at steveleder.com. There's also there are also links there to his books. Rabbi Leder, First of all, we're going to have a whole follow-up conversation at another point in time just on the subject of Israel, because I think that there's a huge amount of confusion among Christians that, you know, some people like to equate Israel with the biblical Israel. It just, you know, all the challenges of that conversation. But I think we need to have that conversation, and I would love to have that conversation with you on another occasion.
I'd welcome that.
Yeah, so today we're about out of time. Here's what I would like to invite you to do, closing today. I know it would bless me, and I know it would bless our listeners. Would you offer us Aaron's blessing in Hebrew?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Yes, that'd be an honor. So Aaron held up his arms in front of the 600,000 Israelites and said the following. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha. May God bless you and protect you. Ya'er Adonai panav elecha v'yichuneka. May God illumine your life and be gracious unto you. Yisa Adonai panav elecha v'yasem lecha shalom. May God always be with you. And may God grant you peace. Amen.
Amen. Rabbi Steve Leader, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith. You have indeed blessed us.
Thank you. It was a great honor to be with you.
All right, friends, I got to take one more break, and then when we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. All right, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. All right, I want to conclude today with two stories about two little old ladies. That's right, two little old ladies and legacy, the idea of legacy. So I've been thinking about little old ladies this week because Mother's Day is upon us. And so if she were still around, she is with the Lord in heaven. But the one little old lady in my life that deserves a shout out every time we talk about little old ladies and their legacy is Robina Ringwald Benefiel. She is my maternal grandmother. And if there's anybody in the world that I am still at 50 aspiring to be like, it is Robina Ringwald Benefiel. And so, Grandma, a little shout out to you. Shout out to your daughter, my mom, Ruth Ann. Thank you, Mom, for your living legacy in me and in Tiana and in Mia and Larry and through, wow, all the students that you had over all the years in all of the contexts in which you taught and served. All right, so the leading story in the New York Times on Tuesday of this week was about a little old lady. So I know that's going to be surprising to you because you would think in the New York Times on Tuesday, the leading story might have been about the hasty resignation of that state's attorney general after allegations of abuse were raised by several women. Or you might have thought that in the New York Times on Tuesday, the lead story might have been about Robert Mueller or the Iran deal or even the First Lady's new Be Best initiative. Nope. The lead story on Tuesday in the New York Times was about a little old lady. A little old lady who worked as a secretary for 67 years. She worked until she was 96. And when she died? Well, come to find out, she'd amassed $8 million and gave it to an organization that helps needy kids in the community that she loved. So the lead story in the New York Times is entitled, 96-year-old secretary quietly amasses fortune and then donates $8.2 million. So let me read the lead. Even by the dizzying standards of New York City philanthropy, a recent $6.24 million donation to the Henry Street Settlement on the Lower East Side was a whopper. The largest single gift from an individual to this social service group in its 125-year history. It was not donated by some billionaire benefactor, but by a frugal legal secretary from Brooklyn who toiled for the same law firm for 67 years until she retired at age 96. She died not long afterward in 2016. Her name was Sylvia Bloom. All right, so the reaction of her niece, Jane Lockshin. Jane Lockshin is also the executor of Sylvia Bloom's estate. The reaction of her niece and the executor of the estate was this, that this was an oh my God moment. I want you to think about that for just a second. Now, nowhere in this article does it suggest, does it say that Miss Bloom was a person of faith. Nowhere in here is any evidence borne out on that subject. But both the response of the executor, Jane Lockshin, who says this was an oh my God moment, and Mr. Garza, who actually is the person at the program that receives this unbelievable bequest. He says we were all agape. We were blown away. Now, when you're looking at this in print and you're a Christian, you see the word agape as agape. I'm just telling you, that's a trick your eyes will play on you. If you're a Christian and you're familiar with the biblical concept of agape love, you know that the love of God is agape love. When you see a person having used the word agape, you're going to look at it and you're going to be like, agape. And so I read this the first time, and I'm reading this, and here's the full sentence. We were all agape, just blown away, recalled Mr. Garza, who said the money would endow the settlement's expanded Horizons College Success Program, on and on and on. And I read it again. We were all agape. What? We were all agape. What does that even mean? I said to myself. And then I'm like, oh, that's not what he's saying at all. We were all agape. We were literally slack-jawed. Our mouths hung open in awe at the gift, at the frugality, at the simplicity of this little old lady. This little old lady, Miss Sylvia Bloom, lived within her means in order that she might bless others extravagantly after her death. She never let on that she had this kind of wealth. And she amassed this kind of wealth, by the way, because she lived in the era when secretaries did everything, including making investments for their bosses. And so as she was the personal secretary of a bunch of attorneys, every time they would make an investment, she would invest in the same thing, obviously, at a much smaller scale. And over the course of time, she amassed quite an estate. Okay, so at the end of the article, it talks about how Mrs. Bloom lived, and she took the subway everywhere. She lived very modestly in a rent-controlled apartment. She was known for always taking the subway to work. And then they say what happened on September the 11th. On September the 11th, she took the subway to work, just like she'd always done. And then the terror attacks took place in the World Trade Center, which was not far from her law firm's office. And so Mrs. Bloom, 84 at the time, fled north. She took refuge in a building until she was able to make her way to the Brooklyn Bridge over which she walked. And from there, she took a city bus, not a cab, home. She took the subway to work on the day of a fierce snowstorm that actually shut down most of the city when she was 96. So one of the attorneys, he says here in the article, I looked at her and I said, what are you doing here? And she said, why? Where should I be? I just really want you to be inspired by this woman's story. This is the kind of little old lady you and I should be, the kind that's blessed to be a blessing, the kind that doesn't take anything for life in granite. We just don't take it for granted. We live each day as an opportunity to do good and to grow good in order that we might leave good. Right? So she has invested in the future now of more kids than we can ever imagine. And this is a woman who we're going to celebrate this week of Mother's Day week, who never had any children of her own. And yet now, because of the way she chose to live her life so simply and investing so well, that she is now able to bless untold generations of children and their children after them, because she's genuinely going to elevate the kids of her neighborhood through the assets that she has left for the benefit of this educational organization. Now, let me talk about another little old lady who's got a bad legacy and who you don't want to be like. So this is the no-no story in this conversation. On the other side of the Atlantic, there's another little old lady. She happens to be dominating the news cycle right now in Germany. Her name is Ursula, and she's known as the Nazi Oma, which means Nazi grandma in German. She has been jailed several times for denying the Holocaust, and her legacy is a legacy of hate and a legacy of delusion and a legacy of denial. This is the opposite of goodness, beauty, and truth. So from the story, I'll just share this. Nazi Oma, Nazi grandma, by German media, dubbed this by German media, was convicted of incitement, that's incitement of violence, last year in a state court where she was sentenced to 2 years in prison for denying the Holocaust, which is a crime in Germany. Now, you and I can debate whether or not it's a good idea to criminalize bad ideas. It's probably not a good idea to criminalize bad ideas. We probably ought to be talking about why bad ideas are bad instead of locking people who have bad ideas up and giving them a platform from which they can then spread their bad ideas. So in her 2015 trial, she said that Auschwitz was, quote, not historically proven to be a death camp. She went on to appear on television saying that the Holocaust, quote, is the biggest and most sustainable lie in history. Friends, an estimated 1.1 million people were murdered at the Auschwitz camp between 1940 and 1945, before the Soviet army intervened, freeing the remaining 7,000 prisoners from that particular camp in Poland. And today, in Auschwitz, at what should be a fairly solemn place, anti-Semitic people continue to vandalize the museum and the site. And so these bad ideas of this Nazi Oma are actually being, you know, woven into new generations. And so as Americans, I think that I think that we need to take advantage of the 28 Holocaust memorial centers here in the United States. If you haven't been to one, please go. If you're a Christian, the history of the Jews is our history. And what you're going to see in those places is not just evidence of the lives of people murdered in the Holocaust, but the evidence of the bad ideas. Yes, the Marxist ideas that came to fruition in the 20th century. Under, frankly, our watch. So if you're a Christian, the history of the Jews is your history. If you're an American, the Holocaust is part of your history as well. Friends, denying the truth does not make the truth any less true. And denying history does not make it go away. So just as we dare not romanticize the ideology that grew from Karl Marx's economic utopian imaginings, we also dare not sanitize what evil has wrought by man in just the last century. Indeed, if we do not study our history, we will be damned to repeat it. If we become people who deny the truth, then we will become people who live in the desperate darkness of the Father of Lies. And I don't know about you, but I would prefer to live in the light, even when the light is piercing and painful, and even when it uncovers and unmasks sin and wrong, than to live in the darkness of denial, delusion, and ultimately death. So, as you are weaving your legacy today, because that's what we're doing. No matter what you're doing today, you're actually investing in the future. And so whatever that looks like for you, I want you to be, I mean, you know, you may not be a lady at all, but if you are, I want you to be a little old lady like Sylvia Bloom. I want you to be a person who lives so well in this generation that you are able to bless the generations yet to come. I want you to be a person who lives so simply that other people can simply live. I want you and I to be the kind of people who people are surprised when we're gone, how much blessing we left behind. Let's not be the kind of person that would be a purveyor of lies and hatred. Let's be the kind of person that builds a legacy of love and generosity and blessing. All right, friends, I got a new ebook posted today at reconnectwithcarmen.com. For those who would like to join us in ministry as monthly supporters, the ebook is 10 Ways to Fan the Flame of a New Reformation. You can find it at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Just click on Become a Reconnector. Friends, I want to thank you for listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.